I'm George Liston, CA. Isabella Greenway lived a remarkable life. In it, she displayed qualities of courage, intelligence, humor, and adventure that led her to high achievement in politics and business. And this at a time when women were constrained in both fields by the dictates of custom and the deficiencies of suffrage. Her life is the subject of a new biography, Isabella Greenway, An Enterprising Woman, by Christy Miller. Christy, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
It is always a delight to have Christy Miller at Dialogue, and particularly after reading this fine book. Christy, let me start off with a perception, an overall perception of this book and this life we're about to discuss. Isabella Greenway's life, in my words, combines hardship and privilege, both of which she met graciously throughout her time. Her background, in the sense, in a monetary sense, initially didn't seem to be terribly privileged, but yet she was, through background, through family, very well connected.
She was very well connected, I think, in two respects. One was the friendship with the Roosevelts. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt's biographer, David McCullough, once said that if Roosevelt and Isabella's mother, Patty Selms, had ever been single at the same time, something would certainly have come of it. There was this strong mutual attraction. Mm-hmm. But Roosevelt was a widower when he met Patty and Tilden Selms. After Tilden Selms died, Roosevelt had remarried. Patty Selms moved to New York in order to live with her sister and her brother-in-law. Her brother-in-law was a successful attorney, and he made it possible for Isabella to go to a good girls' finishing school and to make a debut.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it was a very Edith Wharton sort of story, because there were undertones of tragedy throughout her life, and that debut was almost a financial necessity. They spoke of investing in her dresses, and the idea was for her to marry a wealthy or at least successful husband.
Well, in point of fact, she makes an extraordinary impression at that debut for her appearance. She's a strikingly beautiful woman, which, of course, I think doesn't hurt her in any, in any sense in what she does in life, and a woman of great poise. And so, I mean, she seems to have struck everyone very, very positively at that moment. But it's interesting, Christy, at the time of that debut or shortly thereafter, when she is in the New York whirl, Edith Wharton-esque type whirl, I think she's even telling her friends, her peers, that social issues are important. I mean, it's at that point, at early point in her life, I was struck by that. She has a conscience she's going to have to act on all her life.
I think so. Her father died when she was 9, and it left her with a feeling of great responsibility for her mother. And she often was introspective, especially when she visited her father's gravesite in Kentucky, and she would reflect that we were put here on earth to take care of people. Mm-hmm. She and Eleanor Roosevelt, who became her friend when they were both in their teens, and Mary Harriman, later Mary Harriman Rumsey, were founders of the Junior League, which at the time was a social welfare organization. I think it still is, although it has now some connotations of being more of a society enterprise.
Right.
But this was a very serious endeavor at the turn of the century in which Isabella participated.
She would marry 3 times. I think Isabella Selms by birth, Isabella Selms, Ferguson, Greenway, King.
That's right.
That's the list. And she would lose her husband by death. And death really accompanied her life in a sense, in a kind of ongoing tragic undertone, if you will.
I think that it was a fact of life 100 years ago. Eleanor Roosevelt lost a baby.
Right.
This was a time before penicillin. The letters, and there were 222 boxes of letters.
Wow.
These people never threw away a grocery list.
there
were many references to, are you eating enough? Are you getting enough sleep? Because the only defense against a prolonged infection was your body's natural resilience.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did not have that, you succumbed. So I think that was a real problem in those days.
Well, in point of fact, the first time this comes through to the reader powerfully in this book is the death of her first husband, Robert Ferguson. Now, he's 19 years older than she is. I think he's a contemporary of her father.
Almost. They mm-hmm. were friends, for mm-hmm. sure, before, I mean, when Isabella was an infant. Mm-hmm. He was a ranching partner of Theodore Roosevelt's, and they all met out there in the Dakotas and in
right.
Minnesota. So that he knew her parents, especially her mother. He was a correspondent of mm-hmm. her mother for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But when she made her debut, he sort of woke up and yeah. noticed her and swept her off her feet in what he described as a Highland raid. He mm-hmm. was the sixth child of a Scottish nobleman who'd been sent to America to make his fortune. Right. He'd been one of Theodore Roosevelt's rough riders, one of his favorite rough riders, as was John Greenway. Mm-hmm. And he probably contracted the tuberculosis during that engagement.
Yeah. A Scottish lord, if you will, who marries her and then actually, not by his own doing, of course, but just by circumstances, gives her this extraordinary burden of his years as an invalid, which are pretty extensive and painful, and finally his death. But it's through that marriage, is it not, that they get to New Mexico and then to Arizona, which is really the setting place for all that's going to happen to her.
Yes. When they were in New Mexico, it was on the western border of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. John Greenway had moved to the eastern part of Arizona, where he was a mining engineer. And he was a friend of Ferguson's, having served with him in mm-hmm. the Spanish-American War.
And the Rough Riders, no less.
One of the Rough Riders, mm-hmm. Again, Theodore Roosevelt's favorite rough riders. He'd been a famous athlete in his college days, mm-hmm. John Greenway had. And so he would come over to try to help out. And during this time, he fell in love with Isabella.
Mm-hmm. And she with him.
And she with him.
Right. But they were both circumspect. This is, I think, in the...
Very.
In light of the times. And in our day, that's kind of news.
Sadly, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they felt it was the honorable thing mm-hmm. to tell Bob Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Greenway offered to go off to Africa and go into the mines there. Mm-hmm. And Ferguson said that if they would promise only to be never to be alone together, mm-hmm. that would be all right. He
right.
needn't go away. And they continued to see each other from time to time. And he allowed Isabella to write Greenway when Greenway went off to World War I, mm-hmm. knowing the solace that correspondence could bring to a soldier
right.
in the trenches.
Right.
And he survived the war, as many did not, mm-hmm. and came back and waited for her 13 mm-hmm. years. I mean, there's something sort of biblical in that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's an extraordinary and charming love story, and you really understand it, but it's sort of very revealing in the context of its times. I mean, this is the way people conducted themselves.
Yes.
And in the fullness of time, they do marry, and John Greenway's quite an impressive figure in his own right and has a commanding reputation in his home state of Arizona. And this perception struck me too, Christy. I'll go at some risk, but I do think he was the love of her life. And a love so powerful that it survived his death to the extent that she would write him or at least talk or commune, if you will, with him long after he was gone. I think probably right until the end of her days.
Yes, when she did marry a third time, she kept John Greenway's ring on her hand.
I didn't know that part.
Put the other man's ring over it. Hmm. And she did write to him from time to time whenever she had difficult decisions or whenever she was lonely and missing him. And those letters are just unbelievably poignant because they were only married 2 years before he died of complications from an operation.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was a terrible shock. But again, with this unbelievable resilience, she was able to turn that tragedy, use that tragedy to fuel accomplishment. And she began by doing things to pay tribute to him and also to Ferguson. And those activities were what led her into politics, which I see as her natural métier.
This is an excellent point, because I see the Greenway marriage and its aftermath as her bridge, so to speak, between an already impressive prior existence, but one that would change dramatically.
Yes.
And bring new things in.
For one thing, he had left her very wealthy. Mm-hmm. So that certainly helped, especially because her most of her activity took place during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And it enabled her to do things that most people couldn't do at that time. Mm-hmm. It also drew her into a circle of high-achieving people that he knew through his mining connections. He was a mining, not only a mining engineer, but an executive and owner of mines. Mm-hmm. And he had powerful people on his boards. And so she met them and had a real power base in Arizona.
Exactly so. You know, it's interesting, Christy, because all of these things and more besides we'll be talking about did in fact happen, but I don't think, I would say none of them would have happened if she hadn't had some kind of internal spirit as well as her other qualities that was there to be brought forth. And let me quote from the book a bit and have you comment on a notion of hers expressed in the language of its times, which I think might give even further insight into what was there in this young woman to come forth. It's from page 61, actually, early on in her story, in the chapter called Cat Canyon. And Isabella had made the surprising discovery that she, quote, had the makings of a man within and the glory of a woman concealing it. One must have some men's common sense to know when to be the woman. It takes some tact to judge. I've made up my mind to be a man for at least 5 years, probably longer. It's interesting. I mean, that is not the way perhaps a woman would phrase this in our time, but I think the meaning is very clear. She saw herself as no less than anyone else on this earth, and certainly capable of bringing forth all the strength to meet any challenge life would give her, no matter what society was going to tell her to do.
Yes, that was at the time when she was in Cat Canyon in New Mexico, taking care of the ill husband and having to do a lot of things and take a lot of decisions that were not perhaps common at that time. This would have been in the 19-teens. Mm-hmm. I think it's very emblematic that she headed up something called the Women's Land Army in New Mexico around that time. Mm-hmm. These were women who went out to harvest crops when the men were away fighting in World War I.
Potato patriotism.
That's right. They called it potato patriotism. And it was not without risk because the 1918 influenza epidemic was raging around the countryside. And a lot of the people she was working with got sick and some of them died. And she felt feverish on occasion and thought she might be catching influenza and dosed herself with quinine.
Right.
But I think this kind of high identification with the things that men do was, again, as you observed, something that carried over later in her life is that she could step in and take over men's roles in the fields, and she could do the same thing in Congress.
Absolutely so, which we're going to turn to in just a moment. Thank you, Christy. And let's take a moment now for me to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Christy Miller, author of Isabella Greenway, An Enterprising Woman. Christy, you mentioned the Women's Land Army, the Potato Patriots, and so forth, and all of that. And, of course, we both touched upon the extraordinary importance of her marriage to John Greenway. Clearly, both of these things bring her into the political and the arena of activism. But tell us how this comes about. I think what I'm really striving for here is the kind of cathartic experience of World War I in her life, her identification with the veterans' issues then, now, and later, and the fact that she didn't just identify, she took it into action in a very entrepreneurial way.
Yes, John Greenway was a real hero in World War I, as he had been in the Spanish-American War. He received a brevet promotion to general at the end of the war. And after his death, she wanted to have contact with the veterans who came to Arizona in great numbers because there's still no cure for tuberculosis at that time. So many people who were not originally from Arizona came to Arizona after they were diagnosed with tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And she used to go to the hospitals to visit them. And one time she went and discovered that they were making little knickknacks to sell in order to get some kind of income. This is before all of the social welfare programs of the New Deal. So she is a person who was very interested in art and architecture, suggested to them that if she gave them some things to copy, that they would have more success if they made prettier, more saleable items. And she promised she would buy their output for 3 months. Well, the next morning she woke up and read in the newspaper that she'd started a new business. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, well, okay, if that's what I've done, I better find a factory. So she got the mayor out of his sick bed and persuaded him to give her an empty church and installed the veterans and members of their families there and created this furniture factory. Oddly enough, or perhaps not by happenstance, there's no actual record to show, Eleanor Roosevelt created a furniture factory the same year in Valkill up by Hyde Park. Right. She wanted to be able to keep some of the farm families in that area on in the area and not have them go to the cities to look for work. So she also founded a furniture factory, and the designs are very similar.
Isabella's is called the Hut, isn't it?
It was called the Hut. The Hut was a slang term for the place where the doughboys in World War I went for rest and relaxation. So she thought that would be an attractive name. Unfortunately, with the onset of the Depression, the business failed. She kept buying up the furniture. Finally, somebody said to her, what are you going to do with all that furniture? Open a hotel? And she said, good idea.
I'm laughing, but in point of fact, this is another major chapter and accomplishment in her life. Let's mention it now and come back to it in a moment. But what she does is build the Arizona Inn, which survives to this day as one of the leading establishments in this country.
Absolutely. It's on the Zagat's best 100 hotel list, the Condé Nast Travel and Leisure. It's going to be 75 years old next year. It's run by her granddaughter, who adheres to all of Isabella's notions of privacy, comfort, service. Mm-hmm. It's just an absolutely idyllic place. And she's managed to update it without losing any of the old charm that were characteristic of the inn in Isabella's day.
You know, even if Isabella had only established the Arizona Inn, and even if she had only, and this is another thing she did entrepreneurially, owned and operated an airline, G&G Airlines, it would be worth writing a book about her. But this is only part of what she did. I want to focus on the Hut a bit longer, Christy, in this sense. In addition to being what it was physically, I also took it as the embodiment of her notion of progressivism. And this is putting her politics in action, so to speak.
Isabella got her start in politics by campaigning for Theodore Roosevelt in the 1912 election when he was running on the progressive or Bull Moose ticket. And she did not even have the vote. New Mexico had just become a state, but they had not given women the franchise. But she went around and registered voters and talked up the colonel to his former Rough Riders in New Mexico and generally found that it was a really exciting thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think you're right that the impulse that led her to open the Arizona Hut, which is that you should take care of people and see that there was equity, that they got a fair shake and that they got taken care of, is a hallmark of the New Deal legislation. She and Eleanor frequently beat up on FDR, trying to push him to be more progressive, more liberal than he knew he was going to be able to be given the political realities. Mm-hmm. And that was always very interesting when Isabella was in Congress and they were in the White House. Mm-hmm. So I think of the FDR policies in a way as being an evolution of the later Theodore Roosevelt policies.
And then in that context, she represents a continuity between the two.
She does, because she had known Theodore Roosevelt in the Badlands. Mm-hmm. She was a bridesmaid in Franklin and Eleanor's wedding, a close friend of theirs for their whole lives after that. And Eleanor really recruited Isabella into the Democratic Party. She'd been a Bull Moose Republican up until 1920. 1924, she was so appalled by the conservatism of the Republicans that she became a Democrat.
Right.
And then Eleanor recruited her to help elect FDR.
Which she does. In 1932, she speaks at the Democratic Convention very powerfully and eloquently on his behalf, and in a kind of a nitty-gritty combat sense, gets the California delegation to support him, which actually is essential to him becoming a candidate and then the president.
That was the most exciting part of the research for this book, George, because I knew about the inn, I knew she'd been in Congress, I knew about the airline. But I hadn't realized that she had a real role in the California switch, as it was called. And I was not just fancying this. The Time magazine, when she was elected herself in 1933 as Arizona's only congressperson, referred to her as having a hand in that switch. Yeah. The man she lobbied, Tom Stork, was also given credit by Jim Farley as being one of the two people most responsible for that switch, which really guaranteed FDR's nomination. Today, we don't realize, I mean, after four elections, he seemed like an inevitability, but he was by no means an inevitability.
In fact, this is another of the book's contributions. I didn't know either that it was that closely run a thing. In fact, it was a cliffhanger in many regards, in many respects. And her role to his success was fundamental. And then, of course, this fuels her own fires, and she has the enthusiasm of many others in her own run, and she successfully runs for Congress herself. This alone, once again, would be a book. The fact that she's... And this is a time, of course, when women had only recently, as you point out, gotten suffrage. Arizona had only one representative. She was going to be it. She finished one... I think she finished someone's term, and then... got one on her right. But I guess the main question is, what did she do? What kind of congresswoman is Isabella Greenlee?
She worked very hard for constituents. I'd say that was what most of her activities were taken up with. Worked very hard to make sure the veterans did not lose their benefits during the initial cost-cutting phase of the New Deal, when they were trying to balance the budgets or at least bring it into some kind of balance. They threatened to cut benefits across the board, and she argued that absolutely could not be done in the case of tubercular veterans. She helped people get mortgages for their homes and farms. She brought a lot of work into Arizona. Arizona had more Civilian Conservation Corps camps than any other state per capita.
You know, and another interesting aspect of all of this and everything you just said is extraordinarily impressive in its own right. In a very personal way, there's another equally impressive kind of thing that happens, because it shows her steely resolve, if you will. And that is, if I got it right, at one point she breaks with FDR. And this, I mean, without breaking the friendship, and that's important to emphasize. But she does, and well, tell us how she does that, why she does that.
She was elected in part because she would have access to the president. That was seen as an advantage for the state of Arizona, that she was going to be able to just hit the ground running and have this close relationship. Now, FDR was a consummate politician, and he would usually try for whatever he thought he could get, and he would not break his heart trying for things that he knew were never going to pass the Senate. And so sometimes she would break with him on issues that he was not supporting, that he thought that she thought he should support. Eventually, this culminated in her not supporting him in the 1940 election. She felt that a third term was something that shouldn't happen, that this broke with precedent too much. And so she supported Wendell Willkie. I hear conflicting stories about whether she really was able to maintain a friendship with FDR after that.
But she did with Eleanor.
She certainly did with Eleanor, because to Eleanor, politics never really got in the way of friendship.
Well, Christy Miller, you write wonderful books, and it's always wonderful to talk to you. And I always end a conversation about a book, a biography, by asking the obvious question about the legacy and the meaning and what one should take away from this and all that. But it strikes me in this instance, I have a kind of special coloration to put on it, because your mother, in fact, bought Isabella Greenlee's ranch property in Arizona, and you, of course, spend a great deal of your life out there. So I guess that puts a special kind of coloration on what Isabella Greenlee's life might mean, and perhaps also a kind of Arizona context to it that you could beguile us with?
I think in the East, and I'm basically from the East. My mother didn't buy this ranch until after I was grown. I grew up here in the East. There's a tendency to overlook Western women, which I think is regrettable on two counts. One, because you don't want to overlook anybody who contributes to this country. You don't want to have a regional bias of any kind. But the second is, the West was actually a much friendlier place for women in politics than the East. I think the kind of people who went West were people who were mold breakers to begin with, and frequently the rigors of the West killed off the men, and the women had to cope, just as Isabella did. And I think that one of her political advisors in New York said, you are fortunate in being from the West, because you can achieve things that somebody here in New York would have a much harder time achieving. And I think that that is true, that these Western women, the suffrage came first in the West. They really set a standard for the rest of the United States to follow. Right. They really were pioneers in more than the physical sense of breaking new ground. But she was the 17th woman in Congress. That was still a very small group of people. And I think that one of the things that really struck me is after I had basically done all the research for this book, I read Sandra Day O'Connor's memoir. And in that memoir, she grew up on a ranch that straddled the New Mexico-Arizona border, very close to Silver City, where Isabella homesteaded. And she said that when she was a child, her family used to go to this old homestead in New Mexico to cut their Christmas trees. And it was a place where Theodore Roosevelt had visited. Now that has to be Isabella's homestead. So there's this connection. And of course, she became an attorney in Phoenix, Arizona, and learned all about Isabella Greenway. So I think Isabella's greatest legacy is that she was a role model for Sandra Day O'Connor. The governor of Arizona today is Janet Napolitano, for all of these wonderful Western women in politics today.
What a marvelous answer. Christy Miller, thank you so much.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Christy Miller, author of Isabella Greenway, An Enterprising Woman. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber, and our assistant producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.